Hi everyone, Jason here. On May the 14th, Stephen and myself will be appearing with the one and only Mark Lewison at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary, Dublin. We're going to be celebrating 60 years of A Hard Day's Night, and we would love you to join us. For tickets, go to paviliontheatre.ie or nothingisrealpod.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. In our last talk, we were going through the first months of John and Yoko's Sometime in New York City. We have now reached the sparkling new year of 1972, the year of the album's release. And to recount the first part, they moved there spontaneously in August 1971, but they are never to return to the UK, and they embed themselves in various local causes. And before long, they've got enough songs together for an album. And if you're recording an album, I guess you might want a band.
So what do? You get the finest musicians in all the land.
Absolutely. New York, a hotbed of recording, hotbed of sessioners. You know, the magnificent album called Chex Notes Ram has been recorded in New York. You can really get the creme de la creme there.
Yes, yes. So that's what you would do. You're John Lennon. Or you could just get a bar band.
Yeah, you could just do a Chuck Berry.
Is that unfair?
Well, the bar band in question is called Elephant's Memory. And, you know, from the get-go, I don't know about you, but I think that's a terrible name for a band.
It is a terrible name for a band.
Yeah.
But it does lead to the Plastic Ono Elephant's Memory Band poem.
Okay.
That's the only redeeming
small mercy
of that name. Yes, yeah, small mercy.
And Elephant's Memory were a band formed between 1967 and 1968 by Stan Bronstein and Rich Frank Jr. And there's certainly something very 1967 and 68 about the name Elephant's Memory, you know?
Yes, it is. It is that, you know, Jefferson Airplane, the plastic pink inevitable exploding.
All of that stuff. Yeah. And where are they at when they kind of enter the John Lennon orbit? How do they get to there?
They have had some success. They appear on the soundtrack to Midnight Cowboy because that's a kind of quintessential yep. New York, and they are a kind of quintessential gritty New York rock band. Interestingly, briefly, Carly Simon was their lead singer.
Mm.
I think Carly and Elephant's Memory should get back together and do a you know, do a reunion gig. That'd be great.
I don't know. It certainly gives us reason to get Carly onto the podcast, you know.
That would be very good. Yes, let's get Carly Simon. I'm all for that. Let's abandon the Beatles and let's do our Carly Simon podcast.
You know who plays that bass line on You're So Vain?
Yes, exactly.
Who plays that?
Yes, it's Klaus. It's Klaus.
So it's Klaus. It's Klaus.
It's what's that phrase?
It's all connected. There you go.
So supposedly what happens is Elephant's Memory record a live set for a Long Island radio station. I imagine that's like, you know, Alan Partridge style hospital radio. But that tape gets to Jerry Rubin, who for some reason passes it on to John Lennon. So I think we can blame Jerry Rubin. So according to, and I have to pronounce this, I think it's Skyock, Gary Van Skyock is how you pronounce that. John listened, he's the bass player. John listened and just loved the tape. He just heard all the ingredients that he liked. So he was very interested and apparently decided to come down to one of our rehearsals at a studio called the Magna Graphics down in Greenwich Village. He stopped in one night. He didn't even make it into the room. Our road manager was apparently out there talking to him for a while. We wouldn't really let anyone come to our rehearsals. Well, of course, if John Lennon turned up, you would say, no, turn him away. We just thought they were putting us on. I think we kept him waiting for about an hour before he finally made his way in. He was very cordial. And said he was decked out in a white suit like he had on the cover of Abbey Road. I have never seen a photograph of John Lennon in a white suit in New York.
No, neither have I, so...
Perhaps it was George Harrison.
who was in his white suit.
Yes, yes.
Hmm.
So apparently they jammed for hours and hours and hours, it says here, and they decided to capitalise on their chemistry and merge the two projects. And Yoko immediately spotted the synergy and went, Plastic Ono Elephant's Memory, poem. It's meant to be.
Meant to be. It's... Look, I'm not trying to dunk on Elephant's Memory. I just think
Yes, you are.
they struck me as just adequate, absolutely fine, really, in a way. I don't know what other bands John might have jammed with. Maybe he was just happy to jam with any band, and it just was like, oh yeah, jamming with a band is fun. You'll do.
Yeah, if I were in New York in 1971 and in a bar or in a club or something... This is probably exactly what I would be wanting to listen to as being the quintessential early 1970 New York rock experience. But when you think what else was kind of starting to happen in New York, it's maybe a little bit early for 1972, but you think what was about to happen in New York, what was the New York Dolls and that kind of nascent punk scene and Patti Smith and the sort of the Loft, and that would lead into... the Ramones and Talking Heads and all of that. I mean, it's like just arriving at the party, or you know, you're going to a party, you go to the wrong house and end up at a different party. And it's a sort of retrograde. It's very Sha-na-na.
Oh, you're summoning Sha-na-na. Why aren't they in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Sha-na-na. You're absolutely right. It's a whole hour you could talk about how John and Yoko, as we said in the first part, kind of, you know, planted themselves in New York City, became synonymous with New York City, and then proceeded to somehow avoid every single significant musical event that happened in New York City in the 70s. And we're kind of talking from about 73 when the New York Dolls appear through to 1980 when you have Blondie at the top of the charts. And it's extraordinary. And, you know, you can listen to a political podcast to go through the politics of New York City in the 70s, where the city almost went bankrupt in 1976 and they were left hanging by the federal government. And, you know, how the city kind of had an underdog status and a kind of a sense of cool at the time. But yeah, John and Yoko, for all of their infiltration of New York City life, managed to avoid anything useful or significant. Maybe that sounds a bit mean, but there was so much they could have plugged into instead of hanging out with Jerry Rubin and co, where they could have actually made a musical difference.
Yeah, this is very definitely not my scene, but I'm kind of looking this up, and it said Patti Smith's poetry reading with Lenny Kaye on guitar at St. Mark's Church in February 1971. New York Dolls were performing in New York early 1972. At the Mercer Arts Center, you know, this was the sort of burgeoning rock scene. This would change everything eventually, and it's right at the beginning. And what does John do? He chooses a sort of good old fashioned saxophone rock and roll band, and maybe this is the point where you sort of think, okay, well, his days as an innovator, his days as are behind him. You know, he's harking back to the music, I suppose, of his late teens.
But then again, you know, if Lennon wanted an avenue into Patti Smith and that universe, Dylan was in Patti Smith's orbit at that point in time. The other thing is, if you want to create a sort of retrograde, you know, saxophone-led, 50s-based rock music in a new idiom, well, that's what the E Street Band are about to do, you know?
Well, exactly, and that's a good point. They are better than the E Street Band. You're absolutely right, Jason. They are better. They are better than.
Elephant's Memory?
Is that not what you were saying?
Oh my God, that's fighting talk. They might have been better than 1973 E Street Band. I think once you get Max Weinberg on board, you can't really fault the E Street Band. Maybe I'm not a huge Bruce fan, but I'll defend the E Street Band.
I'm only joshing with the folks.
You're only kidding. Yes. And you also have 1972 is, if you think New York music, Steely Dan. So there's lots of stuff going on in 1972. And it's a pity, as I said, that John and Yoko managed to miss all of these potential avenues to do something, you know, kind of wild and interesting.
It's odd, given how plugged in Yoko had been to the New York scene in the early 60s. You know, and it is, I suppose, that radical left political leaning, you know, I don't know what the politics of the New York Dolls were. I can guess, but it is that sort of old-fashioned, now looking back, it is that old-fashioned left-wing agitprop rock style that would date very quickly.
And their first appearance with Elephant's Memory is at the start of 1972, and they record 5 episodes of the Mike Douglas Show, another one of these afternoon talk shows, from the 31st of January to... between the 31st of January and the 7th of February. And it's a show that they appear on every day, and they each do a song every day. So first day, John sings It's So Hard. Second day, Yoko sings Midsummer New York. Third day, Yoko sings Sister Oh Sister. And this is the famous episode where Chuck Berry appears, and John and Chuck Berry do their thing with Yoko on the floor, and there's a cookery demonstration. And it's... I'm glad we got footage of John and Chuck Berry together.
I'm glad... But it is not good. You know, it really is not good. And, you know, this is, they should, you know, I'm a huge Yoko fan, but she should just have sat that one out. They should just let John and Chuck
do their thing.
Do their thing, yeah.
Then day 4, John does Imagine. And on day 5, they sing Look at the Irish. And Yoko does a Japanese folk song. And this is kind of the first public appearance of John and Yoko and Elephant's Memory. They still haven't hit a recording studio yet. And something else that's worthy of maybe a full episode in and of its own right, but is worth mentioning here, is that last week in January 1972, there's a certain P. McCartney in New York City as well, talking to John and trying to build bridges and make amends.
Yes, essentially, we touched on this at the last episode. Essentially, this is where they sort of agree, look, we should just cool everything down, stop sniping at each other in the press. And that sort of stops, you know, that comes to an end. And there's a degree of, I suppose, civility to a degree returns to their engagement. They both realize this is just completely counterproductive.
Mm. And it's probably also worth flagging, on the 30th of January 1972, the Bloody Sunday shootings happen in Derry, which is something that's going to inform a John Lennon song and a Paul McCartney song that we will come back to later on. But John and Paul are finishing up their business together when this event breaks on the news. And we have talked about this before back in our Red Rose Speedway episode, which everyone, our Wings Wildlife Red Rose Speedway episodes, way back in the last decade. And so they are in each other's orbit for that. In February, they give an interview. John and Yoko give an interview to the Aquarius UK TV show. This is Tony Palmer, who's already done the music documentary. So he's already recorded Beatle interviews.
This is a really fascinating. There are little clips of this up on YouTube. It's never a thing up on YouTube. But it's for the sort of statements that they are making. So John says, we are touring this year. That's 1972, in the US and in China.
China.
That's not going to happen. You know, all the money will go to the poor and to prisoners. It's not going to happen. Mm. And then he says, for free. We're touring for free. What are you going to do about that, Mick? Because what's happening at this stage is the Stones in June of 1972, it's already been announced, the Stones are going to be touring in June and all through June and July. And this is the STP tour. You know, this is the kind of most excessive rock show to date. And this is the Stones will be their first appearance in America since the Altamont gig. So he's already throwing out this gauntlet to Mick Jagger. We're going to be touring. We're going to be doing it for free. we're going to give all the money away. It's a contradiction in touring for free and giving all the money that you make from touring away. But it is this kind of just, he's running off at the mouth in the way that John Lennon does, you know?
There is this pivot that's happening in live rock music at the time where there are huge gigs, there are sound systems that can, you know, that are different to what the Beatles were playing with. You know, it is not even 6 years since Candlestick Park when John is making these statements. And, you know, the Rolling Stones tour of 1972, as you say, it is well known for its excess and the associated documentaries from that time with and the names would attest to that. But it is also, I would say, that Stones 1972 tour, it is maybe the first of these tours that is a 60s legends grand rock and roll tour, that it's a commercial venture. It's there to make money. It's a party on the road. It's everything. It's chaotic, but it's managed chaos.
It is.
And they are making a ton of money, and it kind of sets up for future tours like the Dylan and the Band tour in 74 and the Crosby, Stills, Nash tour in 74. These kind of big money making ventures of the bands from the previous few years.
Yes. George, 1974. Let's not talk
George
about that.
George, 1974, that legend one as well. But the other thing, the other great tour that's happening in February 1972 is, of course, the Wings University Tour. Whether that was on John's radar at all, I don't know. But there's a kind of, yeah, there is an obvious question to ask John, which is, are you going on tour? And it's a version of the Get Back, let's do it in an amphitheater in Libya type nonsense where it's all pie in the sky.
Yeah.
We're going to tour China and give the money away. It's like, oh, really, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, you think at this point, John basically at this point doesn't have much money because everything's tied up in Apple. The receiver's been appointed. His income is restricted. He's borrowing money from Klein. It's always a good idea. Borrow money from Klein. Pie in the Sky is exactly it. And it's sort of the tail end, and John is still attached to it, but it's that tail end of, you know, the Democratic Convention in 1968 and, you know, mobilizing where sort of the Love and Peace era had tipped over into student action, and you had the riot, you know, student riots in Paris and Grosvenor Square and all that from 1968. But, you know, hey, man, that was 3 or 4 years ago. But John is still moving in those circles and those kind of left-wing, agitprop rock.
But you could also argue that it is very removed from reality, you know.
Oh,
it's,
absolutely.
It's kind of the only kind of talk like somebody who's reasonably comfortably off in their status could talk about.
It is a gift to the satirist. You know, where John is appearing in, you know, combat fatigues and you know, raised fist power salute and all the rest of it. And and then heading back to you know, his comfortable lifestyle. By 73, they'll be in the Dakota.
So, you know, no better time than at the end of February 72 for, one, their visas to expire, so they can't really leave the country, and two, to begin sessions for some time in New York City. All the omens are there, hanging out with Jerry Rubin, hiring Elephant's Memory Band, no visa, and they've got, they put the album down quite quickly in about 3 weeks.
20 days, and because in the midst of all that chaos, you need a calm hand at the studio controls. So Phil Spector, hooray,
woohoo,
turns up again.
To know him is to love him, as the eventual cover of the album says. So they record the album in New York in 3 weeks. It is essentially an album version of the Ballad of John and Yoko in some ways, it could be argued. It's certainly cut from the same cloth. What it is lacking is a bit of editing from a Paul McCartney figure who can throw in some sugar sweet harmonies when needs be.
Some melodies, you know.
So yeah, some melodies would be nice, but we are, you know, we're not fans of the album, but it certainly needs a bit of loving.
It does. And I think it's something you do need to see the context, and it is a period that I really do hope this box set comes out, because I think there is so much material there, audio, visual, And there is so much context. And although we're kind of sort of, you know, making fun of it, I mean, these are sort of sincerely held beliefs, and it was a different time. And they are being incredibly creative in the sense that there is a lot happening. There's a lot, you know, they're simultaneously, John and Yoko are producing Elephant's Memory. They will produce an album that only comes out in America on Apple. They will ultimately start working on Approximately Infinite Universe with the same sort of lineup of musicians. So it's an incredibly creative period. But yeah, context is everything.
No, context is everything. And it's easy for us to kind of be a bit sort of tongue-in-cheek sarcastic about it. The reality is they have spent, when they walk into the studio on the 1st of March, 1972, they have spent 6 months in New York City, and they're going to spend 3 weeks documenting those 6 months. And in their mindset, it is, you know, we will do this, we will get on to the next thing, we will get on to the next thing. And hopefully we're giving a bit of context here to say, this is how, when they went into the studio in March 72, this is why they had this batch of songs to perform in this particular manner. And, you know, this isn't going to be how every John and Yoko album is for the future. This is just how this one particularly happens to be. So it is, yeah, context is hugely important. So let's kind of walk through the album by going through the songs themselves. The first song, we're going to call Woman Is.
Woman Is.
Woman Is. And, you know, perfect choice for lead single from the album. And irrespective of the lyrics, it's arguably not the best tune on the album. But the sentiment is probably what's worth talking about as opposed to the actual words.
Again, this is, you know, the sentiment is laudable. It's just very clumsily expressed. And both lyrically, and it is one of those hugely over-the-top, bombastic Phil Spector productions that he does so well. The controversial title of the song is actually a Yoko phrase, and John refers to this in the Live in New York City album that comes out much later. He said, the next song is one of those many songs of ours that get banned. I'm not sure how many of his songs had been banned. It's something Yoko said to me in 1968. It took me until 1970 to dig it. And the phrase was coined by Yoko in an interview with Nova magazine, published in March 1969. They used it on the front cover
of the magazine. Yes. Yeah.
They put that phrase on the front cover of the magazine. And Yoko explains, you know, when I got together with John, that was the biggest macho scene imaginable. That's when I made the statement, Woman Is. And the first sort of demo with sort of half sung, half mumbled lyrics dates from 1969, summer of 1969. Could have been a Beatles.
So it could have been squeezed onto the medley.
Could have been put into the middle of After Me, instead of Mean Mr. Mustard, or yeah, it could have been, yeah, perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or else, you know, when Paul says, you know, have you got another song that's not Cold Turkey? Hold on. How about this one? Okay, let's do Cold Turkey. I like how Yoko talks about, you know, the music scene was the biggest macho scene imaginable. Macho is one of these words that Yoko uses a lot.
Yeah.
And she uses it with withering disdain, and it always makes me smile whenever there was some quote about John. You know, when John was making bread, they were doing an interview, and Yoko says, and because men are macho, he had to show me the bread, or something like this. And I just find that a very funny Yoko thing. Whenever she says macho, it's just, she's totally slagging things off. But, you know, the phrase obviously is the whole point of the phrase is that it is confrontational.
Yes.
And that it makes you think. And, you know, they are sloganeering at this point in time, war is over if you want it, and all that kind of stuff. So it makes sense as a slogan, as a bit of advertising, as a bit of attention grabbing, to get there. And, you know, the history and protest is full of people doing provocatively awful things in order to actually say, how do you feel? You know, if you feel this way about this, why don't you feel this way about this other thing associated to it? You know, and, you know, climate activism might be a modern day version of it. You know, why are you gluing yourself to the road? Like, just that, I'm not gluing the road, I'm trying to draw attention to something, god damn it.
Why are you throwing soup at Van Gogh?
Why are you throwing soup over Van Gogh's? Yes. And
I was in London, but I was at the Tate.
Do you no while you missed
were,
out
I missed it while they were throwing soup
or you have an alibi
I have an alibi I was at the Tate Gallery and
But an action like that is a provocative action, which is, you know, and I think the legitimate extension of that is to say, well, if you're upset at that, why aren't you upset about this other thing? That is the point that they're trying to make. And as we said, this kind of comes from a Yokoism. There's also that there had previously been people who have said, you know, women are the slaves of the slaves. I think even James Connolly had said that at one point, the Irish, I don't know what you call him, signatory of the 1916 Easter 1916 Proclamation of Independence.
Revolutionary, Irish revolutionary.
Irish revolutionary is probably the best way to call James Connolly. So Yoko's phrasing of it is unique to Yoko. The notion that women are the slaves of the slaves is not necessarily a new notion, but obviously, like a good advertising person, that's why she came up with that slogan.
That's exactly it. It is sloganeering, and they're very, you know, John is very keen to trumpet or advertise his feminist credentials around this time, 1971. But it is again very apposite, because you do get all of these revolutionary movements in the late 60s, but the women are in the kitchen, or the women are painting the signs while the men are, you know, coming up with the ideas and organizing and marching and all the rest of it. But the difficulty with slogan is it's couched in language that is not going to get any mainstream traction. It's all very well in 1968 for Nova to have put that on their front cover, but by 1971, no mainstream media outlet is going to use that phrase. Now, John did not use this phrase casually, so he you know, canvasses opinion from various people saying, look, if I use this word, is this all right? In this context, will this be misunderstood? Are you sort of fine? And one of the people he speaks to is Dick Gregory, who I guess is not well known in the UK, but in America, he's since the early 60s, he's a sort of, he's a comedian and civil rights activist. He once stood against Richard Daley as mayor of Chicago, etc. And he, you know, he speaks to people like that. And in October 1972, in Jet magazine, he says, you know, yeah, they consulted and it's fine. And he's making a very powerful point. Dick Gregory is on what's known as Richard Nixon's master list, you know, his enemy, oh, yes, enemies of the presidency. And I sort of knew there was a list, and I went and looked that up. John Lennon isn't on the list. Yeah. I bet you John was really annoyed.
Probably upset about that.
That he wasn't on that list. But yeah, so they issue this as a single on the 24th of April 1972, Apple 1848, and it peaks at number 57. It did not receive a release in the UK.
It didn't. It was supposed to be released in the UK, but they withdrew it. And, you know, for all the kind of the maneuvering, you know, that we are using around this word in 2022, you know, the whole point in 1972 was that it was a word that was not acceptable back then. Using it. And, you know, John is trying to make a play where to say, well, look, is there an artistic reason for using this word? And, you know, you could argue that there's been an artistic evolution of this word in hip hop music over the last 40 odd years. But it is what it is. He runs into this belief, though, that John does, that it's going to be a massive number one, that it's going to be a huge hit. And so much so, there's Pete Bennett, who's a kind of a record plugger, kind of has this discussion with John about how this is going to play out.
Yeah, yes, Pete Bennett talks about this, and he actually, he's Apple's US promotions man. He says, I told him I wouldn't promote it. So John says to me, well, you're our promotions man. You have to listen to us. We pay you. I'm the president of Apple. And I said, John, I don't care what the story is. I don't want the record. I'm not going to promote it. If I don't like it, I won't promote it. So John says, I'll promote it. I'm going to make it number one. And I said, without John knowing, I checked out all the radio stations and they said they weren't going to play it. So John called all of the stations himself, tried to do a promo job. He was so happy and he came back. You know, he'd called the program directors and they were so nice to him and they took the interviews and all the rest of it. And they played the interviews, but they wouldn't play the song. So, you know, it stalls. And what Pete Bennett says is Apple sent 30,000 records out, 15,000 came back.
Oh boy, ship platinum returned. shipped cardboard returned platinum, or however that phrase works.
I can't and so this is the first time, I suppose, since 1962, October 62, that John Lennon is looking at a flop record.
Now he can point to the reasons to why it's a flop, you know. It's just too ahead of its time, or it's too confrontational, and I don't mind, blah blah blah. But you know, he does try and do his own push. It's performed live on the Dick Cavett Show with a big explanation as to why I am saying the things I am saying.
Dick Cavett is made by the network to read out a statement ahead of the show.
Yeah.
And Cavett would say, we did get 600 complaints, but the 600 complaints were about me reading out the statement, not about the song itself. So, I don't know. The UK, you know, can you imagine that being played on Top of the Pops?
Well, they said that they withdrew it, obviously, because Happy Christmas War Is Over had also managed to get a belated release. So there's an argument that says, oh, we don't want two singles in conflict with each other. But what we'll come on to later is the whole album has a rocky road to getting released in the UK anyway.
Yes.
It kind of falls down between two stools. You know, it's perhaps too late in December 72 to release it as a single. The shock is already out there because the album's already out there. It does get performed live by John at the 1-2-1 concerts in August 72 at Madison Square Garden. Bit of a toe tapper for the crowd.
So there are two performances of that concert. The afternoon performance is on the Live in New York City album in 1986, which I really hope they remix, put out in full, Yoko's performances, everything. And then the evening version is on the John Lennon anthology box set that came out in 1998. So, you know, that gives you an indication there are at least 2, 3, 4, 5 live versions kicking around, plus demos that go back as far as summer of 1969. So there you've got a whole EP on a box set.
But it still doesn't forgive the fact that it's not a good tune. You can't dance to it. You can't whistle it. It's just like, it's a smack over the head.
It is. It's a big bombastic production number. It's none of those things. And it goes on quite a long time. And it's not a good album opener. I think I'd have put it maybe at the beginning of side two, but it's not something that makes you think, hey, this album's going to be great.
But I'll tell you what happens next is one of my fave moments on the album, track two, Yoko's Sisters, Oh Sisters, which is written by Yoko. And as we said in the first part, Sometime in New York City is actually the first John and Yoko album.
Yeah.
So it's the follow-up to Imagine, and if you're expecting more Imagine No Possessions and whistleable tunes, track two, here we are, in your face, Yoko with Elephant's Memory doing kind of a 50s style bop, but that is a catchy tune.
It's a great tune. I really do like this this song a lot. And you know, she starts off by saying, no chauvinist pig engineer. You know, so they're kind of, and John goes, you know, right on, sister. So there's a little kind of jokey undercutting of the message, but it's a great tune. It's a kind of danceable tune. It's a whistleable tune. It's everything that the woman isn't.
Yep. Yeah, no, it's a great song. It's kind of, and it does have that kind of Phil Spector kind of echoey bop going on to it. And as we've said in the first part, it's a song that has popped up in previous months when they've been on the David Frost Show, when they've been doing the John Sinclair rally, and it also popped up when they were on that run of Mike Douglas shows. And you know, it's just a great tune. Also pops up in the Madison Square Garden gigs.
Yes, but say it's not been released. So I mean, in 1980, John is giving interviews around the release of Double Fantasy, and he's talking about this song. And he clearly likes this song, and he's saying it's a sort of reggae beat, and he is claiming credit for being the person to introduce reggae to the United States.
I mean, you know, Wings Wildlife, Love Is Strange, Hello, like, surely that introduced reggae to
who does he think he
American
is?
American audiences.
Donovan?
Yeah, exactly.
there's a string arrangement, and this is my fun fact. The string arrangement is credited to Invisible Strings, and it was arranged by Ron Franchipane, and they were overdubbed afterwards. He was in the Archies.
Amazing.
Sugar, Sugar.
But the Archies were just a state of mind. They were just sessioneers anyway, weren't they?
But so he was one of them. And the next thing he's so from Sugar Sugar to Sisters of Sisters.
Next track, track three, is Attica State, which was written about the prison riot in September 71. So we've touched upon Attica State a little bit already. But the riot itself is kind of a grisly horror story that maybe might be more forgotten about. This song kind of brings it back into some form of living history. But Attica State, it was a prison. And this was seen as a riot or an uprising or a massacre. It's the bloodiest prison riot in U.S. history.
So depending on your sort of political standpoint, it's either called the Attica Prison Massacre, the Attica Uprising, the Attica Prison Riot. But essentially, it's in the early 70s, there was this rise in, I suppose, the use of prison as a punishment. And basically, there were demands for prisoners' rights and demands for better living conditions, political rights. And on the 9th of September 1971, 1,200 out of approximately 2,200 people in the Attica prison rioted. And they took control of the prison and took 42 staff hostage. There were 4 days of negotiations, and eventually 28 of the prisoners' demands were accepted, but the authorities would not agree for the removal of the superintendent or a complete amnesty from prosecution for the takeover. And the governor, Nelson Rockefeller, put the state police in.
Yeah.
And at the end of that exercise, 43 people were dead, including 10 prison officers, civilian employees, and 33 inmates.
And that number 43 is something that John refers to, that he talks about the death.
43 poor widows.
The death involved in the riot, yeah. Yes. His claim at the time was that I am sad, I'm not being pro-prisoner, I'm not being pro... you know, prison guard. I think all of the lives there were should not have been lost in that riot, and they're all worth commemorating. So, you know, the criticism that's thrown at him was that, oh, you're just, you know, liberal lefty, you know, playing for prisoners, and he's like, no, all of it was wrong when Rockefeller kind of pressed the button to make it happen.
Well, I say yes. I mean, he sings in the song, you know, Rockefeller pulled the trigger. So he's laying the blame very, very much at Rockefeller's door. And it's an incident that has quite a tale to it, that in December 1976, the then governor sort of said he was going to close the book. And he did pardon all the inmates, and he dismissed the disciplinary proceedings. The families of the prisoners killed sued, and in 2000 they received... $8 million dollars in compensation. I think it is seen as a kind of pivotal turning point in terms of prison rights, and we mentioned before this was written or composed or initially begun on his 31st birthday back at that Everson show, and they recorded various demos, and again it was sung at John Sinclair, sung on the David Frost show, sung at the Apollo Theatre. And the last time he performed it was on the 20th of February 1972. Again, that Tony Palmer. And that it is a great version. It's just Lennon kind of dobro guitar singing it. And it gives you a little bit of an insight into what that album could have sounded like. Stripped away, stripped of the Spectre production, without the full Elephant's Memory band. And there were maybe perhaps some more intimate acoustic solo performances. That's probably my favorite version of the song.
Yeah, there are demos from November 71, and you know, maybe those demos would have the kind of the key version. There certainly were drawing together a picture of an alternative version of this album that has a very different type of feel. I think sometimes you could argue the studio kind of the studio vibes from the album make it feel a bit removed, where, you know, they should have perhaps had a musical direction that was as direct as the the themes and the lyrics.
Well, you think of exactly, and you think of Dylan. It's those early protest songs of Dylan. They're sung with an acoustic guitar directly into a microphone, and there's something very visceral and direct, and you engage with that. Whereas when it's hidden behind the sort of bombast of a big band Phil Spector arrangement, I think it gets lost. So if people haven't seen that little clip, that little YouTube clip, it's well worth checking out.
Yep. We'll stick up a link to that. The next track on the album, it happens once or twice on the album where these songs appear in pairs, or there's kind of a duality, or there's a John take and a Yoko take. So following Attica State, there's Yoko's song Born in a Prison, and that has its roots going back to Yoko's Yoko's grapefruit book.
Yes,
was what I was trying to say.
Every home should have a copy of Grapefruit that you can just pick up off the shelf and get some instructional vibes from time to time. I love that book.
Well, even on Twitter today, Yoko's aphorisms, you know, they certainly have a voice and a style, and they are drawn into the lyrics of this song. You know, they are good lyrics.
Yes. The idea is it's not a sort of literally about prisoners. You're just saying, well, you know, we're born in a prison. We're all sort of born into this this life in a prison. And you can sort of consciously break out of that. So, the lyrics are, you know, wood becomes a flute when it's loved. Reach for yourself and your battered mates. That's an odd line. Mirror becomes a razor when it's broken. Look in the mirror and see your shattered fate. So there is something there, I think. And it's performed at Madison Square Gardens. It's not on the album, but it is on. If you have a VHS video player, you can get that performance but it's a terrible mix of that album.
Yeah, but it's also a good tune, Born in a Prison. It's got a nice seesaw tune.
It is, and it's more of a sort of acoustic vibe, and that's what I'm saying. If it's stripped back a little bit, I think this album is something that a sort of a remix of this album, I think, would work very well like a stripped back, like the Double Fantasy version.
Well, particularly for the next track, if we're talking about this album being the seeds of it going back to the Ballad of John and Yoko, no more so than the track itself, New York City, which is the 6 months from the 31st of August to the 1st of March, John and Yoko. This is the Ballad of John and Yoko in New York City, a sequel. And it's a good tune. I mean, this should have kicked off the album.
This should have been the opening track of the album. Yeah. This absolutely should have been the opening track of the album. And this is absolutely the kind of stuff that Elephant's Memory are the perfect band to play, because it's a kind of good old-fashioned kick-ass rock and roll song. And the interesting thing is he's recording the first demo of this in September, 10th of September 1971, when they've just moved to New York. They're in the St. Regis hotel. He's still working on the lyrics. He's got the tune. He's got the Que Pasa New York, which is such kind of hip speak. You know, this guy from Liverpool. Yeah. Hey, Que Pasa New York, what's up? You know, it's all... He's just locked into that, and he's sort of improvising around the words. And there's an early version appears on the anthology box set.
Yeah, it's a great rockin' song. Again, a little bit of air in the mix in a remix would make it really soar. And it's when you talk about the demos going back to September 1971, it does impact on you how John kind of responded to the city very, very quickly. And he'd been in New York before. He'd been there with Paul in 68, and, you know, he wasn't a stranger to the city. But somehow when he arrives with Yoko at this time and meets these people and meets this network, it obviously has a very large effect on him. And whatever we might say about the album being, you know, somewhat dated, or some of the posturing kind of being a little bit obvious, but I believe the album is completely sincere.
I think that's true. I think this isn't just posturing. We can, as I say, we're slightly sort of sarcastic and cynical about the whole thing. But the one thing you could say about Lennon, he may have picked up and discarded causes quite quickly and quite regularly, but when he was involved, he was absolutely involved and absolutely sincere. And I think it's very indicative of this kind of visceral reaction to New York. And he is completely invigorated by this and he's excited by this. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting is just going into the album, how excited he is. And then once the album comes out and the single doesn't do well, how quickly that then starts to fade.
Yep.
But you sang about it opening the album. This is the song he opened the concert, the Madison Square Garden concert with, quite rightly so.
Yes, yeah.
You know, it would be a fantastic album opener. And yes, I think air in the mix is what is required.
And even John himself in 1980, you know, makes the connection with the Ballad of John and Yoko, who's, you know, because the song, he says, you know, the Jerry in the song is Jerry Rubin, the bloke with the guitar is David Peel. The album was represented as a newspaper. The song's a bit of journalese, like the Ballad of John and Yoko. It just tells the story. And yeah, it's a great rockin' song. That is the end of side one.
End of part one. Intermission.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
End of intermission. Part two.
And we have to start with side two. We have to start somewhere. And we should probably take the next two songs together because side two opens with Sunday, Bloody Sunday, and then track two is The Luck of the Irish. And what we've kind of been pointing out so far is that The Luck of the Irish is already a song that is in the mix at the end of 71. They're playing it at TV shows and concerts. And, you know, without going into a huge amount of geopolitical discussion, but the 1971-72 period in Northern Ireland politics is perhaps the most awful part of what are colloquially known as the Troubles. There are many books about 1972 itself. And while John and Yoko are taking all of this in and writing a song called The Luck of the Irish, we have the Bloody Sunday atrocity on the 30th of January 1972. So it makes sense, again, this duality in the album, that these songs get paired together.
Yes, and it is interesting that The Luck of the Irish already exists. You know, so sort of issues in Ireland, issues in Northern Ireland already sort of on his radar. But yeah, this is a direct response. So there were 13, 14 people ultimately died, were shot by the British Army, five of whom were shot in the back. It is still a controversial issue. There are still inquiries and litigation still going on.
Yeah, for listeners around the world outside of the UK and Ireland, it is extraordinary how potent this event still is. And even, you know, it is a topic in the current Parliament in the UK about the rights of the people involved in this issue and the Conservative government's position on these kind of things. It is a hot button topic to this day.
Yes, because the big issue at the minute is there was an initial inquiry, which I think everyone regarded and accepts was just a whitewash. Then there was a further inquiry, and there were hundreds of millions of pounds spent on that inquiry. And then you had one side saying this is a complete waste of money, the other saying, well, this is, you know, absolutely essential. You know, very much the blame is focused on the government and the British Army as a result of that inquiry. But there is now this idea, well, we have to prosecute the soldiers who were involved. And then the contrary view is, no, everybody gets an amnesty and it's back and forward, back and forward. But it is such a pivotal moment in the Troubles, and such, as you say, it is still such a controversial event. I'm almost at the point of saying you could not write this song today, but you could have written the song in 1972 as a direct and immediate response, because it was just a black and white issue. Now it has become, I don't want to say toxic, but it has become so, you can't talk about it. You cannot have a conversation about it without being drawn in. And everything now in this world is black and white. It's a binary option, you know?
No, 100%. Like, even now, I sense you and me are choosing our words
very
wisely
carefully
on an event that happened 50 years ago. And, you know, if I'm thinking of our North American viewers, you know, if you're trying to think of something comparable in terms of popular culture, maybe Crosby, Stills and Nash's and Young's Ohio,
yes.
Because Bloody Sunday on the 13th of January 72, as you say, it was an unarmed civil rights protester group were protesting for civil rights. Civil rights in this instance was Catholic civil rights in Northern Ireland, and there was the British Army fired on, shot 26 people and 14 died, and as you say, it is a controversial topic that is still being played out in the political sphere of the UK and Ireland. Again, choosing my words wisely, but it is when they were already tuned in to issues at that time through the Luck of the Irish, Sunday Bloody Sunday is written to be, in case we haven't made our point clear, we are going to write more directly about this issue.
Yes. Lennon says, you know, most other people express themselves by shouting or playing football at the weekend, but me, I'm in New York. I hear about 13 people. There were 13 people had died. And I react immediately. And being what I am, I react in four to the bar with a guitar break in the middle. Paul reacts similarly, you know, so he has a reaction to that. And his response is to write what is perhaps the politest protest song ever written, and it's fascinating to compare the two songs and the nature of the response, because John is just absolutely out and out unequivocal in his reaction to this. Paul is much more, I don't want to say nuanced, because it isn't nuanced, it isn't sophisticated, but he's not unequivocal. He just doesn't want to call Britain out too harshly.
It's worth just paying close attention to the timeline. So obviously the song we're talking about is Wings' first single, Give Ireland Back to the Irish. You know, the events happen on the 30th of January. Paul has Give Ireland Back to the Irish recorded 48 hours later.
Yep.
By the evening of the 1st of February, Paul has it recorded, and he has it released on the 25th of February. So before John even sets foot in the studio to record sometime in New York City, even, you know, though he obviously has Sunday Bloody Sunday written, Paul has already written his response. And it is a fascinating, again, you talked earlier on about the similarities in John and Paul's lives, the bits that were the same on paper but different in reality. Here you have two partners who are approaching this totally separately, and you kind of can't help but think, good Lord, if because Paul was in New York at the end of January, if he'd been there for an extra few days, like a double A-sided single with a John song on one side and a Paul song on the other, raising money for charity, if it was Sunday Bloody Sunday and Give Ireland Back to the Irish, like that's an extraordinary notion. I know it's a bit of a parallel history thing that we try and avoid, but it is amazing that this event provoked very specific songs about a very specific, like unequivocal songs,
yes, so to speak.
That I think you have to look at them in tandem with each other.
Yes, absolutely. I think the response is the same, but the expression is different. And it is fascinating to think that, you know, if they had still been, Paul had still been in New York, well, perhaps they'd have written a song together, you know. And again, we don't get a song from George. We don't get George and Ringo penning something at this stage, but this is Paul, and Paul, who is not political in any sense at this stage, this is what sort of galvanizes him into this response. The money from this song and Luck of the Irish are donated to the civil rights movement in Ireland and in New York. And if you were to talk to people in Northern Ireland about the civil rights movement. Again, even that's a contentious issue because the idea is, you know, is the civil rights movement part of the IRA? Is the IRA, you know, legitimate? Do they have legitimate aims? You can't discuss these things. But John, at this point, you know, he, to an extent, he recognises the difficulty of the contradiction, and he's moved from, you know, you can count me in, you can count me out in revolution to part of the people. If you want a revolution, we'd better get it on right away. And again, that's a comfortable, you know, rich rock star saying that. But he, when it comes to Ireland, and there's a quote from him in September 1971, which is 4 months before the Bloody Sunday incident. And he said, "I understand why they're doing it. And if it's a choice between the IRA or the British Army, I'm with the IRA." That's a quote that came back to haunt him. "But if it's a choice between violence and non-violence, I'm with non-violence." So it's a very delicate line. So he, that's one of those quotes that just gets taken out of context.
Yeah.
He then says, and I actually think this is funny, he concludes that by saying, "Although I condemn violence, if two people are fighting, I'm probably going to be on one side or the other, even though I'm against violence." And that's, I think that's like saying, "Well, I'm a vegetarian, just between meals."
Well, it's, you know, the luck of the Irish, because we're looking at these two together, you know, before he left for the US, John had put the shoe leather in. He had been on a march in London in August 71, you know, which was a protest march, you know, where he gives that interview in quote in response to it. And the back end of that, he writes the luck of the Irish around about November 71 in response to these issues. So, but this is kind of a powder keg that is building up to the Sunday, Bloody Sunday kind of event.
Absolutely. And I mean, that protest march in London was literally the last thing they did before they got on the plane. You know, they just marched, kept marching all the way to the airport.
All the way to Heathrow.
What I would say, just going back to Sunday, Bloody Sunday, I think that song is fantastic. I think that is a brilliant song, objectively. I think it does exactly, it fulfills the brief, because you've got this absolutely driving production, this driving song. The lyrics are, as I say, scathing, visceral. There is no ambiguity about the message, and it works perfectly. Then you come on to the Luck of the Irish, which I think, for my money, is probably the worst song on the album.
In history,
in the whole of history. Shockingly bad song. I mean, even, you know, I speak as someone that, you know, Irish, living in Ireland, even without that, the kind of, it's awful. It's terrible.
It is awful, and Shamrocks and Rainbows and all that kind of
stones, and
yes, it might as well,
leprechauns. Yeah, leprechauns get a mention.
Leprechauns get a look in. Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, it would have been better if they had ditched Luck of the Irish and just used Sunday, Bloody Sunday to make their point.
It was considered as the potential lead-off single.
Well, unless kind of, you know, Kinder Eyes thought, well, it sort of has a Mull of Kintyre vibe, doesn't it? You know, it's
sort of,
D&D die, kind of, you know, nice air to it.
It is such, well, even that line, "If you had the luck of the Irish, you'd wish you were English instead." I mean, that is so ambiguous and open to misinterpretation. And
I don't know if any Irish person has ever wished they were English, but anyway, let's not go there.
And then you get Yoko's, sorry, Yoko, but you get the unbelievably twee, which is just like an Irish tourist board, you know, "The mountains of Bourne and the Blarney Stone and Galway Bay and blah, blah, blah." It's anyway,
yes.
Have we said enough that it's bad? We don't like
it. I think we have said enough about those two songs. But yeah, it was considered as a single with Attica State, and I don't know what the, I mean, like, New York City should have been the single. What, like, I don't know. Like, that's just obvious to me, anyway, in retrospect. Yes, so still at topics we are tiptoeing around 50 years later, Sunday, Bloody Sunday and the Luck of the Irish. So there's potency there. Next track is John Sinclair. Now, we've kind of covered the story of John Sinclair in our first party. They gave him 10 for 2, and the song was written for his Freedom Rally in December 1971, and he gets released three days later. So why they bothered to record it, Well, it's just a bit of a good jam, isn't it? A good tune.
I think it's just, you know, he could have repurposed this, or he could have changed the lyrics, or, but yeah, this is exactly what you don't do. You do not put out a protest song after the subject or the object of the protest has ceased to exist. You know, he's out.
Yes.
So there is no reason to put this song on the album, you know?
It does make me think of Bob Dylan's song Hurricane. You know, it kind of has a precedent for that. I know John Sinclair isn't the first protest song or the first song to protest a, you know, miscarriage of justice. But it in terms of the vibe of 70s rock, it does present this notion of, you know, it's slightly different to the reportage of Attica State, this thing happened, or Sunday Bloody Sunday, this thing happened. Whereas with John Sinclair saying, I'm going to shine a light on this guy.
Yes.
And we're going to get something done. And, you know, it did do its job. So, you know, I'm glad it's on the album.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's interesting to have. I still would send people back to the Tony Palmer documentary version. But it's Hurricane is a good example. And Dylan had a song called George Jackson.
Oh, yes.
Around the same time. And, I mean, you know, it has kind of little echoes through this album as well. But yeah, you sort of folk, but you know, Dylan's not going to sing Hurricane or George Jackson in concert now. You know, once it's done, it's done. Yeah.
Yeah. And Hurricane also has that word in it. So you're not going to hear it on daytime radio. The next track up is Angela being Angela Davis, Black Panther supporter who was tried and eventually acquitted for suspected involvement in the murder of Judge Harold Haley in California. And Angela Davis is still someone who is a provocative figure.
Yes.
He said...
provocatively.
Again, choosing words wisely.
She is. I mean, she is still around. She is still speaking. She's very prominent in the Black Lives Matters. Black Lives Matter movement. So yeah, and again, a bit of a cause celebre back in the early 70s. I like this song a lot. I like the melody. I think some of the lyrics are unbelievably twee.
Yeah,
but this is a song that benefited hugely from that remix in on the Gimme Some Truth box, and I think it's interesting that this is the song they chose for that box set.
Yes.
Because Black Lives Matter was a huge issue around that time, and this is a song that sort of focused on that, other than that, you know, we couldn't have the Woman Is song obviously on the box set. Mm-hmm. but this was a nice representation. Didn't begin life that way.
Okay.
So originally the song was called JJ, Angela JJ. And I'm just reading a third person song about a woman who, checks notes, couldn't get laid at all, unquote. That's a lyric.
Right.
And if you want to seek out, there is a demo recorded in September 1971 at the St. Regis Hotel. And there are lots of other versions, and it becomes called People. And then it's a sort of, you know, peace and understanding people, and then it becomes about Angela Davis. And the connection here is Jonathan Jackson, a 17-year-old high school student, basically took over control of a courtroom in Marin County, California, and his brother was George Jackson, about whom Dylan writes the song. But anyway, things go horribly wrong. He arms the black defendants, takes the judge, the prosecutor, and three female jurors as hostages. There is a shootout, basically. One of the defendants shot at the police. The police returned fire. The judge and the three black defendants were killed. And it turned out that Angela Davis had purchased several of the guns and had been corresponding with one of the inmates involved. So she's actually charged with first-degree murder. She's not there. She's not participating. She goes on the run. And then she's captured by the FBI in October 1970. And June the 4th, 1972, the all-white jury said not guilty. So that was...
Yes.
You know, so...
So while the song is being recorded, she is still incarcerated and this trial is taking place. So this song is very much...
It's very much...
Of the moment.
Of the moment. Because, you know, Richard Nixon congratulates the FBI on the capture of the dangerous terrorist Angela Davis. That's it, like, he, Nixon has form here. He comments on the Manson trial and almost... Yeah. There's almost a mistrial because the president is weighing in on with his opinions, and I think it's a really nice melody. If you can ignore mm-hmm. its sexist origins, and I think this is a really good song, but not as good as the song the Stones wrote about Angela Davis.
Now, this is the song Sweet Black Angel, which is on Exile on Main Street. And already that title is giving me the vapors, with the fetishization of black culture. But anyway, what do they sing on the album?
Do you want me to read the whole thing?
Oh, go on.
I'm not going to do my Mick Jagger impression.
Please don't.
Well, the gal in danger, the gal in chains, but she keeps on pushing. Would you do the same? She counting up the minutes, she counting up the days. She's a sweet black angel, not a gun-toting teacher, not a red-loving schoolmarm. Ain't someone going to free her? Free the sweet black slave. Yeah, I can see what you mean.
Jesus. Oh, yo.
But it's a great, but it is a very good song.
Oh, what, their hearts in the right
their
place?
Their hearts in the right place. Their hearts in the right place.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, and Angela Davis, as you said, still fighting the good fight today, yeah. A very, very, very interesting voice in the current debate. This leads us to the last track on the album, which is a Yoko one, the longest track on the album, called We're All Water. And again, this is, some of her old lyrics being refashioned into a, her old poetry lyrics being refashioned into a song. Again, another kind of great Yoko tune and bop. And
I love this song, yeah.
I love this song too. And what we kind of need to keep in mind is that Yoko is going to spin off from this project and release two fantastic albums.
Yes, yes.
Approximately Infinite Universe and...
Feeling the Space, which is her kind
Feeling
of,
the Space.
Which is a great album, kind of feminist.
Feeling the Space is great. Approximately Infinite Universe, they're probably her two best records. They're my two favourites anyway. And so We're All Water is how the album closes. And the original poem, You Are Water, I'm Water, We're All Water in Different Containers. That's why it's so easy to meet. Someday we'll evaporate together. But even after the water's gone, we'll probably point out to the containers and say, that's me there, that one. We're container minders. Thanks, Yoko. Cool.
Heavy stuff. She reworks this. And it's it's another one of those songs, one of those performances, one of those productions that is perfect. And the Elephant's Memory Band, ideal for this. And of course, she just goes full Yoko at the end of the track. Brilliant. And
it's a great track. Great way to end the album.
And she adds references to Richard Nixon, Jerry Rubin, Charles Manson, the LP cover. We talked about this, not really talked a lot about the cover, but it's mocked up like a newspaper heading, the sort of slogans, Phil Spector, to know him is to love him, a riff on the New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, etc. I think we didn't mention that the Everson Museum program is done up in
that's
the same
right.
way. So from the year before, so there's a sort of foreshadowing in the design of that. But one of the pictures that illustrates this is Richard Nixon and Mao Zedong jiving naked.
Yes, very much of the time. But that's the whole point of the album, you know, that we've moved on 6 years on from Aha, Mr. Wilson, Aha, Mr. Heath. This is the kind of the national state of world politics. And... this was a mocked up image that they have. And John is still talking about it in 1980 that, they were getting pressure for having these, that retailers stuck a sticker on it. And John said, this is the kind of pressure Yoko and I were getting, not only on a personal level and a public level and the court case and the effing government and this, that and the other. But every time we tried to express ourselves, they would ban it, cover it up, would censor it. Now, part of the point, probably the alternate to that, saying, well, you're being provocative. You know what you're doing. But
yes.
At the same time, he's saying, we are being provocative, and that's just the way it is.
Yeah, you want to get banned. That's part of the point, you know?
And We're All Water does get performed on the Dick Cavett Show, and it does get performed in August 1972 at the one-to-one gigs. Now, depending on which version of Sometime in New York City you have, either the album ends there, and that's that, and you go off and have a cup of tea, and certainly some of the reissues, particularly the digital reissues, have ended the album there. There is a second live album that comes with the album itself.
Live which is Jam.
Live Jam, which is comprised of 1969 recordings made in London, and then also of a second set of recordings made with Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention in New York City. You could spend a whole episode talking about those recordings.
You could.
So maybe we should just do that.
I think we probably should.
I think we probably should do that. So that is your bonus album. But so they record this album very quickly in 3 weeks' time. They also record an Elephant's Memory album, and John and Yoko pop up on the Elephant's Memory album itself.
Have you heard that album?
No, I've never heard that album. I'm assuming you have, because you're
yeah, you'll not be surprised.
You're in it for real.
You'll not be surprised to know I have several copies of that.
Well, you have to hear the 8-track version.
Well, you know, it only came out in America. Interestingly, it was not. So did David Peel's Apple album only come out in America, but I only look at UK Apple releases. But I made an exception, and boy was I sorry I'd made an exception. Yeah, it's not great. It's more of the same style, but with even more terrible lyrics, and not good. It has not aged well. That's all I'll say. It has not aged well.
So the album is due to come out on the 12th of June in the US. And so once the album is in the can, it's at this point that they go on to Dick Cavett and do the version of Woman Is that we mentioned earlier on. And Dick Cavett has to make the apology. And that gets broadcast on the 11th of May, 1972. So, you know, having done all this stuff in December and January, which is kind of low key, when they reemerge in May 72, the album's in the can, they're presenting the single, they're performing with the band, Elephant's Memory. It's not unimaginable that, you know, they have a band in tow. They should have hit the road, and they might have been in a different place if they'd hit the road, but they didn't. The single itself comes out on the 24th of April, and they're still doing peace rallies and things.
Yes, so they're still doing what they did before they went into the studio. So there's a benefit concert at Washington Square on the 13th of May. So they're still involved in these activities. And then they start rehearsals for a concert. And various members of the Elephant's Memory Band have said, yeah, we were going to go on the road. Now, I don't know that that was conceivably that could ever have gone to China. Only Nixon can go to China. But yeah, so they're sticking with the lineup and the band that made the album, and they start rehearsing for this benefit concert one-to-one. The rehearsals start on the 18th of August, and 31st of August, two sets, Shades of Bangladesh at Madison Square Garden.
It is Shades of Bangladesh, and, you know, when Sometime in New York City does come out, it, as I said, it's the 12th of June, 72, it does not come out in the UK until much later. It gets delayed about 3 to 4 months and comes out in September time. So at that point, you know, you could argue that this whole flurry of activity is over for them in terms of kind of acting in New York. When the album comes out, amazingly, it charts shockingly low.
Yes, it does very badly. It does very badly. And
it's kind of hard to believe how badly it does, particularly coming off the back of Imagine. So it charts in the US at number 48. Good Lord. Like, that is, how can you explain something like that, you know? Like, the Imagine had managed to get to number one in America, and number one in the UK, the Imagine album. So that's within the space of a year. The follow-up album to Imagine goes to number 48 in the charts, which it is kind of unfathomable. Like, I could understand it getting into the top 10 and disappearing a week after, but that is a very low chart position.
I think by that point, you know, we tend to think of Lennon as being slightly reclusive because, you know, in the latter years and all the rest, but he was constantly on the television, in the New York area, people had heard these songs. People knew what these songs were like. You know, 4, 5, 6 of these songs had all received public airings on syndicated talk shows, et cetera, et cetera. The public didn't like it. The public didn't want it. You know, it was overtly political. So let's say half of your audience on the political spectrum are going to be ruled out of buying this. It was not something that I'm guessing anybody over 40 is going to lock into. You know, imagine nice, sweet, sugar-coated, Lennon says himself. This is completely the antithesis of this. And it's been previewed. So already he's sort of locking out various sections of his audience. Plus, of course, George was king of the world, and George was the number one Beatle in 1972, and Ringo was the second Beatle in 1972. But it is a catastrophic fall from grace, I suppose. And I can now do 45 minutes on the ramifications of this, on the royalties and the Alan Klein's deal with Capitol, because if you remember...
Let's just save that for another day. I know. I can see that look in your eye. I mean, you know, the follow-up album that comes out is Mind Games, and that does put Lennon back into the top 10. But it is amazing that the public got this sense off the album and stayed away in droves, you know, that it was signposted so clearly. But it does all build up, as you say, to, you know, the album is out, Elephant's Memory are there, he's based in New York. This 1-to-1 show kind of is the first anniversary of their arrival in New York City, and it kind of is the bookend to those New York 12 months. And it's, you know, August 71 was Bangladesh, and here we are, August 72, John is headlining a charity concert. It's a very different beast, different vibe, doesn't sell out. Like, what is this concert for?
Well, I will now read from the New York Times on the 17th of August, 1972. This is so not politically correct.
Well,
there's another one of these words, Jason, coming up.
Yes.
Can we say it once?
I think we should read the headline once, yes.
Okay, and I judge from your silence you're going to make me read the headline.
I'll read it if you want.
No. The headline on the New York Times on the 17th of August, 1972, Lennon concert slated August 30th in all-day fete to aid retarded.
And yes, that is a kind of another word that's been... retired somewhat.
Yeah, this article is full of words that you can't... But essentially, on the 30th of August, starting with a variety of programs in Central Park at 10 in the morning and ending with a benefit rock concert in Madison Square Gardens featuring John Lennon, the festival is being organized by Geraldo Rivera.
Geraldo.
To raise funds to help and personalize care for children who were in a, I suppose, state-run institution. And essentially there was going to be a day of folk singing, circus performances, social dancing and parades. Yoko was decorating part of Central Park. And then the Lennons will be joined in the evening concert by Roberta Flack, hooray, Stevie Wonder, hooray. Shanana. God, they're everywhere.
Seriously.
Would it have been better if he had just got Shanana in to record?
to be his backing band.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen their television show, Shanana?
Oh, no, please, no.
Okay, never mind. It's on YouTube. It'll rot your brain.
And the Isley Brothers, I would like to have heard John Lennon record sometime in New York City with the Isley Brothers, all of whom are donating their services. So... you know, this is a charity concert that Geraldo has put together. And the Times actually says the rock benefit recalls last year's concert for Bangladesh in Madison Square Garden, in which George Harrison and Ringo Starr, two other former Beatles, performed. No pressure.
The thing about this is, you know, okay, so it's a charity... you know, it's being raised for this Willowbrook Institution charity for, you know, children with developmental issues. And, It's actually the first non-controversial charity they've stuck their name to. It's not like we're doing this one-off gig for, you know, the whatever kind of rights issue they might be playing at. You know.
Yes. Yes. And I mean, it's hard to escape the feeling that John felt this was something that people could get behind, that this was non-controversial. You know, the album by this stage is out and stalling. The single has stalled. Obviously, there's the Bangladesh echo of that. His career is stalling. George's career is forging ahead. Ringo's career is forging ahead. One of the interesting things is in 1986, Yoko talked about this concert. And what she says is the Vietnam War protest was at its height. The feminist movement was in a stage of awakening. Our concert material was mainly based on the album we released that spring. The concert was filled with love of brotherhood and sisterhood. We passed out tambourines to the audience, true to our slogan, "You Are the Plastic Ono Band." Everybody joined in and staged at the end. We sang "Give Peace a Chance." The concert was our effort in grassroots politics. It embodied what John and I strongly believed in: rock for peace and enlightenment. No mention of Willowbrook or the children.
No mention of the fact that it's a children's charity gig. It's a bit rich, that. The set list itself, I mean, if this was to be the opening night of a tour that would have gone across North America until Christmas, pretty reasonable set list just to rattle through it. Power to the People, New York City, It's So Hard, Move On Fast, Woman Is, Sisters of Sisters, Well, 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 Born in Prison, Instant Karma, Mother, We're All Water, Come Together, Crowd Goes Nuts, Imagine, Harake, Cold Turkey, Don't Worry Kyoko, Hound Dog, and Give Peace a Chance. If anything, the argument was that they weren't really road veterans when they take the stage, John and Yoko, and the Plastic Ono Elephant's Memory band. It's a bit, you know, the shows are somewhat undersold, but it's you know, it's still the closest you'll get to a proper John gig, really.
It is the only sort of full set that you'll get. On paper, it's a good set list.
Yeah.
You know, that would be a good rockin' night out. But the band do sound under-rehearsed. And this is a band that has just recorded all of these songs in the studio, and they spent a couple of weeks doing rehearsals. But they sound under-rehearsed. What I would say, they also have Jim Keltner, interestingly, is on the stage for this. It does not sell out. And you think, again, John Lennon in New York, Madison Square Gardens, does not sell out. Very strange. Lennon buys $60,000 worth of tickets himself and hands them out. It raises money, it raises awareness, but as a musical event, I think it falls very far short of what you would expect, and it certainly compares very unfavorably with Bangladesh, and he just can't escape the Bangladesh comparison. There is a review on the 31st of August, hot off the presses. Don Heckman says, "Visions of the now classic concert for Bangladesh danced in the heads of the less than capacity audiences at the one-to-one concerts in Madison Square Garden yesterday afternoon and evening. But the realities of the two sluggish, sometimes good, sometimes bad programs soon drove away any expectations of a truly memorable event."
Yes, he does also say, you know, you kind of forget that there's a support bill. Shanana, as delightful as ever, stomped and sung their way through a maze of 50 sits. But I also like how Stevie Wonder, he brought with him music and the audience life. However, he has a cracking new song called Superstition. I love it when a new song drops.
Imagine that if you were in the audience and heard, and you did not know this song. And I mean, that would have been fantastic.
This review does say, I think totally fair, "Yoko's extraordinary vocal improvisations may be an acquired taste, but they open an area of sound for its own sake that widens the colour spectrum for what could be an important new rock ensemble." I think that's a phenomenally open-minded and fair thing to say in a review where they could have just kind of ignored it. But yeah, not a great review. Friend of the show, Harold Lapidus, has been to the gig. We should pick his brains.
We should. He was in the audience. We should. He was there. Yeah. He was there. Yeah.
He was there. And the point is, though, there's been talk for a number of years that there's a remixed, redone version of these one-to-one shows on a shelf somewhere in Lennon Ono Towers waiting for a reissue. And whether that's part of a Sometime in New York City reissue or whether it's a standalone, you know, live issue with rehearsals and afternoon show, evening show, and then the remastered 4K film with surround sound. That's how I'd do it.
Yeah, it's a box set in itself because I've got a CD bootleg of the rehearsals, and they are just kind of goofing around on old rock standards. And what I would say is the closing paragraph of that review, it said, who was there at the end? Shana Na, Stevie Wonder, Roberta Flack, the cast of Godspell, it's very of its time, Abby Hoffman, and I think he's the new Cilla Black, Allen Ginsberg.
Allen Ginsberg.
to sing Give Peace a Chance. So we have to ask Harold if he noticed Allen Ginsberg there. But
yes.
Anyway, it raised $1.5 million. So.
And isn't that all that matters? Yeah, maybe it will get, you know, as I said, it's apparently all been done and ready to release, but we just haven't seen it yet. But I think the most important effect of this one-to-one concert was that Paul named his 2016 tour the one-to-one tour, which...
In tribute.
That's obviously exactly where his head was at. You know, the concert's on the 30th of August and the reviews and the aftermath on the 31st of August, and it is a year to the day exactly that they arrived in New York City. They got an awful lot done, and if they hadn't been in New York City, that 12 months would have been a completely different period in time, really.
Yes. It is an absolute continuation of the Ballad of John and Yoko, which is sort of how you introduced the first episode. This is them documenting what's happening in their own lives with New York City and what is happening around them and the causes they are involved with. And, Jerry Rubin gets name checked, David Peel gets name checked. Unfortunately, Allen Ginsberg does not get name checked, but, it's that sort of diarization of their lives and the causes they're interested in. And then suddenly it just stops.
It does all peter out for numerous reasons, I guess.
Yeah.
One is, the album flops. Two is the immigration situation. Three is the nature of John and Yoko's relationship starts to change as 1972 becomes 1973.
Nixon gets reelected. All of that comes to bear. And I think, Gary Von Sciak, Skyok, I need to learn how to pronounce that. He is very adamant that they'd been rehearsing and they were geared up for a tour. And he says, you know, it was the immigration issue. But I think because all of that is going on in the background and Lennon is fighting the immigration services, the FBI are out to get him. He is becoming increasingly paranoid. He's being convinced by his lawyers, look, as long there is political opposition to you staying in the country, as long as you are identifying and hanging around with Abby Hoffman, with Jerry Rubin, people like that, this is impacting on your ability to stay in the country. And back to the original purpose of being in the country was to try and find Yoko's daughter. And that has sort of been in the background, hanging over all of this. So there's a sort of series of circumstances all kind of building up to the point where he's got to make a decision. Does he stick with it, what he's doing with the sound, with the politics, with the course of his life, or does he retreat back into something more like Imagine, which I would say Mind Games is really sort of Imagine light.
Mm.
But I think the biggest factor is probably the commercial failure of the album and the single. And it impacts him, it impacts the Beatles, because Klein has to spend a long time arguing with Capitol to say this record should not count. This is a John and Yoko album. It's not a John solo album. And, you know, you won't let me talk for 45 minutes about the contracts. But this becomes a huge issue. And I think it's suddenly the commercial. He's not had any commercial failure since the first single.
Yeah. Yeah. This is it.
You know?
And you know, at the time, rock and roll careers, you're only as big as your last record. You know, there isn't, you can't release a flop album. There's one interesting postscript to this first year in New York City. On September the 4th, 1972, Jerry Lewis is having his annual Labor Day muscular dystrophy telethon, which, if you're a North American listener, I'm assuming is just part of life for many, many years, that Jerry Lewis would do this very large telethon. And it's being broadcast from the Americana Hotel on 7th Avenue in New York City. And then Jerry Lewis makes one of his fantastically unctuous introductions as he introduces two of the most unusual people in all the world. And I don't mean just in the world of entertainment. They fit no patterns, meet no standards except the standard of excellence. Ladies and gentlemen, John Lennon and Yoko. And finally, we get the Jerry Lewis, John and Yoko trio that we've longed for a long time.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Together again, they could have gone on to conquer the world.
Who needs Dean Martin?
John, Yoko and Jerry in Vegas at the Sands, live at the Sands. That would have been...
Yes. And they, John and Yoko, come out, and with Elephant's Memory, they do Imagine, Yoko's Now or Never, and then they do a sing-along version of Give Peace a Chance. And to be honest, it's kind of, it's all a bit sort of, a bit, my thoughts was it's a bit Roger Waters, where it's the legend is more important than the actual art itself at this point. And it does need a bit of a tearing down and a rethink, you could argue.
Yes, I think I think so. And that is probably... You know, a line is drawn at that point, and we kind of tip into the silly season the following month, where rumors are circulating of a concert with Wings, John and Yoko, George. You know, Yoko is recording Approximately Infinite Universe, which is an insanely good album and much, much more interesting than Sometime in New York City. January 1973, Northern Song sues John for £1 million. This is Lou Grade and the publishing. John then is heading off to LA, recording the Ringo album. John, George and Ringo meet in LA. And my question is that the first time any of the other Beatles have seen John without Yoko since March 1968?
And the answer's possibly yes.
Answers on a postcard.
Yeah, answers on a postcard. Yeah. And then as the 31st of March, 1973.
Big day, Klein contract ends.
It's a big day. It's a big day in Beatleland. But that's all ahead of them. That's all ahead of the band.
And May, Yoko was giving solo concerts with the Elephant's Memory Band. And Melody Maker say she can write songs about things that matter. John Lennon is married to her, you know. Remember him?
Yeah, Yoko's on a roll at that
she
point.
She absolutely totally is on a roll. Weirdly, Weather Report are the opening act at that concert. I mean, Weather Report are opening for Yoko. Brilliant.
A brilliant parallel universe. But yeah, what a year. I think by pulling that apart and having a look at it, maybe the album makes a bit more sense in terms of a diary or something disposable. And we're certainly waiting still. As I said, all of this, you know, we started discussing this in the context of hoping there'd be a box set. Hopefully that will still come to add even more context and thoughts to what this album actually is.
If Sean Lennon, we'd like to come on and have a chat. We are firmly, firmly, I think we can say we are firmly on his side that the box set should come out with the running order, with the track list, as was intended, plus all the other good stuff. So, Sean, if you'd like to come on, and he could perhaps also enlighten us as to the last great unreleased project of that era. In September of 1973, John leaves for LA and The Lost Weekend, and it is announced that a planned musical by John and Yoko and Shirley MacLaine about Watergate has been scrapped.
Yeah,
is it too late? Is it too late to resurrect that?
I find that possibly not true. Anyway, what do you think, everybody? As usual, we want to send you back to the records. Go back and listen to Sometime in New York City and see what you think. We remain available in all the usual places. We're on Twitter at BeatlesPod, the Nothing's Real Facebook group, the website www.nothingisrealpod.com, which is a gateway to all the other stuff that that we are up to. And we're always glad to hear from you. And there's extra bonus content over on our Acast Plus channel. And thanks to everybody who's already subscribed. But for now, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.